listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
10 years ago, the international media nicknamed scientist Ian Wilmot the world's most famous shepherd. His laboratory at Scotland's Roslin Institute had made headlines with a lamb named Dolly, the first animal ever cloned from an adult cell. Now Ian Wilmot, who is a professor of reproductive science at the University of Edinburgh, has teamed with journalist Roger Highfield to write After Dolly, The Uses and Misuses of Cloning. The book is published by Norton. I'm very pleased it has brought Dr. Wilmot to my show today. Hello.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's been said that Dolly's birth is the biological equivalent of splitting the atom. Was it as difficult, do you think?
No, it wasn't. It is an important advance, but I don't think it's as important as that. It did require bringing together a number of different skills, and it depended on sophisticated manipulation apparatus. If I tell you that eggs that my colleagues manipulate are smaller than a grain of salt, you'll understand that requirement. But I don't think it's in the same league as splitting the atom.
There's a lot of confusion about cloning. Can you explain the process of creating a clone?
To clone, you have to have two cells, one of which is an egg, which you take from an animal around the time when normally it would be mated. And the first thing you do is to remove the genetic information from the egg. The second cell, in the case of Dolly, came from mammary tissue from a pregnant animal. And you grow those cells, you treat them in a particular way to make them to be suitable for the nuclear transfer. And you use the same micromanipulators to put one of those cells next to the egg from which you've removed the genetic information. And then we use an electric current to do two things, to fuse those two cells together as a way of introducing the genetic information and to stimulate the egg to resume development. In effect, in this procedure, the electric current replaces the sperm because it kicks off development and it delivers the genetic information.
But you're also removing the genetic information from the egg and then replacing it with other genetic information. So you're creating a different egg.
Exactly. And it will have essentially all of the inherited characteristics of the animal from which you took that nuclear donor cell.
Is that the only way that you can do cloning?
There are minor variations, but essentially this is the only way. It depends a little bit on your definition. You can take an embryo and split it in half.
That's called twins.
Yeah, that's right. But some people would regard that as cloning. If you're wanting to make a copy of an adult animal, then this is indeed the only way of making a clone.
If the DNA and egg are from different animals, does the donor egg contribute anything to the resulting embryo?
Yes, it does. The other small part of the genetic information is in the little powerhouses inside the cell, the mitochondria, and we believe that the mitochondria in a cloned animal will come from the egg.
So it's not a pure clone. It'll be different in some ways from the original.
That's correct. That's just one of a number of ways in which the animals will be different. Another is that we're all shaped by the environment that is provided by our mother's womb. It will also have some small differences just by chance.
So that'll be a nurture aspect. You've taken care of the nature part, but the nurture part is also there, and that determines how an animal turns out.
That's exactly right. These are important components. So we just provide the best genetic information, best control of the genetic information that we can, but there will be other factors which intervene, which make the clone not exactly like the original.
Has all of your work been directed toward cloning since you began?
No. The common theme is working with gametes and embryos. I worked initially on freezing sperm, and then moved on and froze embryos. The group were successful in producing the first calf from a frozen embryo.
That was Frosty?
Yes, that's right. It's not very imaginative, is it?
It's called the Frosty?
Yeah, you'd be pleased to know that my wife had more say in the names that we gave to our children. Yeah.
But was that a step toward thinking about the creation of Dolly, or is that totally different?
No, I think that's a little bit further on. The thing which led us to think about the cloning procedure was a project to enable animals to make proteins, human proteins, that are needed to treat human disease by a process of gene transfer, of genetic modification. The procedure which we used at that time in the late 80s was to inject a few hundred copies of a gene into the nucleus of an early embryo, and it worked. And the first products from this approach are now in the clinic and offering treatment that's not available in any other way.
Those are the two clone sheep, Megan and Mark.
No, this is further back than that. This is Tracy would be the best known animal, I guess.
Tracy, how do you come up with these names? I know Frosty.
Yeah, I don't remember how we came across the name Tracy. Dolly, of course, we know is christened after Dolly Parton because of the fact that that cell came from mammary tissue.
Mm. Oh, well, very subtle. So how many years of research went into Dolly? I've read that there were 226 failed attempts with you and your partner Keith Campbell tried to come up with a Dolly.
I think the answer is 10 years, but the amount of effort that went into the project increased as we began to be more successful. So the last 2 or 3 years were probably very intensive when we produced Megan and Morag and then Dolly. But it was, and it still is, a very inefficient procedure. Only 2 to 5% of the embryos that are made, cloned embryos that are made, will become live offspring. So it is an approach that you need to adopt systematically and know that you're going to have to perform very large numbers of these micromanipulations if you're going to be successful.
How were Megan and Morag different from Dolly?
They were produced, the dogma more than 10 years ago was that it would not be possible to clone from an adult. And the reason is that all of our cells have genetic information. Most of them have exactly the same genetic information. We have many different tissues, muscles, eyes, everything, because that genetic information functions differently. And we used to believe that the mechanisms which organize that were so complex and so rigidly fixed that it would not be possible to reverse them. So all of the earlier research had been with cells taken from embryos, when the belief still is that the changes would be relatively minor and perhaps it would then be less difficult to reprogram. So Megan and Morag came from cells which had been grown from embryos, but which had changed a little bit. So at that time, which was a year earlier than Dolly, it already seemed a significant step forward. And it was with that experiment that we introduced two modifications to the procedure, which I think we then knew would enable somebody at some point to clone an adult. We didn't know it would be us a year later, but we knew it was going to happen sometime.
How close was that work with embryos to the other area of cloning that we hear so much about, stem cell research?
But at that time, it was sort of separate. The human embryo stem cells were described by Jamie Thompson and his colleagues from Wisconsin a year or so later. So I think we had it in the back of our minds that this might all interrelate. But the thing which really brought it forward in an exciting way was the coming together just a year apart of the Dolly paper and the human embryo stem cell paper.
My guest is Ian Wilmot, who's written with the help of Roger Highfield, After Dolly, The Uses and Misuses of Human Cloning, written by somebody who's actually conducted cloning, but not human cloning. The book is published by Norton. Why do you use sheep? Is there a reason that all three, and why, is there a reason that all three of the sheep that you cloned were female?
The reason we use sheep is that the institute that I worked in, Roslin Institute, was initially concerned with animal science. And the most interesting animal from an agricultural point of view is actually the cow. But cows are very expensive, and they have a very long generation interval. So it would take twice as long to do the same experiment in cattle as it does in sheep. They're also difficult to operate on and to work with. But we knew, fortunately, that sheep and cows are very similar in their reproductive biology. So if you like, you could say that we used sheep because they were small, cheap cows, and we were using them as a sort of test system.
Was Dolly Parton impressed? Was she pleased when she found out that you'd borrowed her name?
I don't know. I think what her publicity agent said was that there was no such thing as bad publicity.
What happened to the original parent sheep?
The animal had been euthanized at the time when the mammary tissue was taken away, because obviously if she'd been allowed to recover from the anesthesia, she would have had pain. And there was, at that time, the cells were taken for a different reason by our collaborators, PPL Therapeutics. There was no point in allowing her to recover and undergo that pain. That's the reason we were never able to compare Dolly with her twin.
But didn't some people, or most people, expect Dolly to be unable to reproduce?
There were all sorts of anxieties about her as to how normal she would be. And fortunately, most of them proved to be unfounded. She produced 6 healthy lambs, and then at that point we decided that, you know, we wouldn't let her breed anymore, because there was always a risk involved in that for any animal. The thing which particularly brought concern was the fact that there were some differences in her cells. There are small bodies on the end of all of our chromosomes called telomeres, which become shorter as each time the cell divides, and so they are shorter in an older animal than in a younger animal. And her telomeres were short, and so there was an anxiety as to what consequences there might be from that.
Well, didn't she die young?
But she died because of a virally induced lung cancer, so there is no doubt in my mind that her death was nothing to do with cloning. Unfortunately, there is no test for this condition, nor any treatment for it. And it's spread in droplets in breath. And as soon as we knew that one of the other sheep in the barn had the disease, we thought that it was extremely likely that Dolly would succumb in the end. And sadly, that's what happened.
But didn't those differences in her cells also suggest that clones will age prematurely?
They do. But unfortunately, because we had to, or we chose to end her life because we thought it was kinder to her, we still don't know the answer to the question. And I think it's still true, even from other people's experiments, that for a large animal like a cow or a sheep, we still don't know. Because if they're given the opportunity, they can live 10, 15, perhaps even 20 years, and none of the animals are so old yet.
Have you cloned other animals since Dolly?
We've done a small number of sheep with the aim of making genetic change, animals like Polly. And we began to carry out most of our studies in mice for practical reasons, and we cloned a considerable number of them.
And you're no longer with the Roslin Institute, so has that changed the focus of your research?
Yes, it has. I've moved into a medical school, and I'm really excited by the opportunity to use my experience to try to understand human diseases and to begin a program to produce cells from cloned human embryos with this in mind.
My guest is Ian Wilmot, who was with the Roslin Institute in Scotland when Dolly was cloned. He is now professor at the University of Edinburgh, has been doing research there, and has written a book with Roger Highfield called After Dolly, The Uses and Misuses of Human Cloning, published by Norton. When we come back, we'll talk about why so many people have misgivings about what he has done. We're back with Ian Wilmot, who is one of the researchers to clone Dolly. He's written a book with Roger Highfield, the science editor of the Daily Telegraph in Brooklyn, called After Dolly, The Uses and Misuses of Human Cloning, published by Norton. I can always blame my clone for making mistakes, misspeaking. The news of Dolly's birth unleashed mixed emotions. There were many people who were enthusiastic, but also a great deal of fear. Did you anticipate the reactions you received?
Yes, I think we did predict the range of views. I don't think we understood the sort of intensity of them and the way in which it would go on for a very long time.
Well, there's some people who believe that cloning in any form is wrong, whether it's human cloning or any other kind of cloning. What do you say to people who feel that you've opened a Pandora's box?
I think that since time began, almost, human beings have been making new discoveries, advancing our opportunities, and very often these have disadvantages as well as advantages, and what we have to do is to learn to choose between them. I mean, if you go so far back, the first time that anybody put a sharp stone into a stick and made an axe, they had something that they could use to chop wood, to kill animals to eat, which we would think would be a good thing, but you could also use them to kill people, which often we think is a bad thing. And I think this is just a fact of life, and we have to face it.
Well, where would you see the practical applications to something like this applied? Livestock? I mean, I could see a situation where we could, even though you say it's difficult to clone beef cattle or dairy cows, well, we could be doing that. We could have a new category, cloned organic. We could do it with sheep as well, which are food animals. And I'm not sure what vegetarians would say under those circumstances.
I think that we would be wise to consider it if we can give animals a characteristic that they can't have in any other way. Let's say, for example, that we could make animals resistant to mad cow disease by genetic change, or resistant to foot and mouth disease by a different genetic change. Then I would think we would be wise to think very seriously about that.
But this is different than genetic modification that so many Europeans are objecting to.
I think it is a genetic modification. It's just a different way of achieving it. And one of the reasons we started this whole process was to be able to make genetic change in animals.
But not to put a fish gene into a sheep.
It would depend if it was useful. I can't think why it would be, but the reason why people use genes from other species often is simply because it's easily detectable. If you put another sheep gene into a sheep, then to detect the change is very difficult, might even be impossible, depending on how careful you've been in selecting that gene. Whereas if you put something in which is markedly different, it's much, much easier to test for and to discover whether or not your experiment has been successful.
You dedicated the book to, I'm quoting, the tens of millions of people who will one day benefit from research on cloning embryos and stem cells. So you now are extending this to stem cell research, which is still a controversial issue in this country because of policies in the White House.
Yep. Let me explain first what could be achieved. If you use this procedure to take the genetic information from a person who has an inherited disease and to put it into an embryo, make a cloned embryo, and then derive stem cells from that embryo, then all of the different cells that you produce have the inherited characteristics of that person, including vulnerability to that disease. Now, one that we wish to study is ALS, otherwise known as Lou Gehrig's disease, after the baseball player who sadly had it. That's a disease of the nerves in the center of the body. You can't possibly obtain those cells to study. The cause of the disease is not known. There is no treatment for it. If we can produce in the lab cells which are equivalent to those of a person who will develop the disease as they begin to show the first changes, it will provide researchers with the first opportunity to study that and hopefully to develop high-throughput drug screens which will enable us to assess the potential value of thousands of compounds. What we would hope over maybe a 5 or 10 year period would be to do this and for the first time to be able to offer to people a drug which would prevent further degeneration of their motor neurons.
But whenever we talk about stem cell research, we talk about its potential. Here you've already cloned a sheep, and yet we really haven't gone very far as I can tell, despite all the money spent on stem research, in coming up with anything.
I think it's rather mixed. I think that you're slightly unfair in terms of changes in farm animals, in that there is a group here in the United States who are producing in cattle human antibodies, which can be used to test for disease and to treat diseases. It may be possible to use these antibodies, for example, to kill tumors in some cancers. This, is sometimes in the future, but that has been achieved, just to give you one example. But I think your comment is fair as far as cells from cloned embryos is concerned. Sadly, the last year or two, we thought that the group in Korea had made major progress, which we now know is not true. But you're quite right. There is a lot more here still to learn.
And why do you think that is?
I'm not quite sure why we have been so slow. I mean, there are real practical difficulties in making the arrangements to invite women to donate to our sites, to obtain all of the ethical procedure and to set up the facilities.
Because in some cases it actually is a difficult procedure and ethics don't allow us to pay them for putting their lives on the line.
Yeah, hopefully nobody is suggesting putting their lives on the line. There may be a very, very small risk of affecting the person's fertility, but even that is a very, very small risk, which would be explained to anybody who is contemplating donation by an independent counsellor who understands the procedures that the person would go through. I think it is fair to say people have been slow, but I think now there are a number of groups around the world who are well organized. There's one at Harvard. I think there are people in California working. There are two in Britain who are working with this approach. And I'm sure there are many in the Far East that we're not even really aware of.
Japanese scientists have created a mouse that has two mothers and no father, the first case of parthenogenesis or virgin birth. Can we expect to see fatherless animals of other species or...
Probably not. I think it's misleading to describe it as parthenogenesis. I mean, another way of describing it I would be more comfortable with would be to say that they use very sophisticated molecular biology techniques to test a hypothesis that parthenogenesis fails because of the absence of genes which function in a particular way, and they manage to get an animal through to term from quite a number of attempts. Its main value is in confirming that hypothesis rather than in offering a way of producing an animal.
That's why we need two mothers, yep. Because the other idea was you could prick an egg and get it started in dividing and create a perfect... a mirror image of the mother.
Yeah, you don't. Two mothers won't work. Some people might feel it would be more than enough. But in reproduction, you need to have a set of genes from a male and a female, because the way in which they function will have been set up differently during the production of the gametes, the sperm and the eggs. And it is clear that that is an absolute requirement.
Now, what about human cloning? Because you suggest that we should clone human embryos, but then add that human cloning itself is criminally irresponsible.
So let's separate some points out. It sadly is a very inefficient process. Many of the animals that are produced with the present procedures are abnormal. And that's the sense in which, at the present time, it would be criminally irresponsible to think of producing a child in this way.
But if we worked it out and knew exactly how to do it, you're less concerned then?
I think it depends on your purpose. The potential use, which I've always disapproved of, is the idea of making somebody who is a genetic twin of somebody who is here already. That's the sense in which clone is usually used. And the reason is because I think that it would inevitably impose expectations and limitations on that child. Many journalists have asked me if my children, who are all produced naturally, are biologists, because we expect our children to be like their parents. I think a genetically identical twin, that pressure would be multiplied many times, and it just wouldn't be fair to the child. That's the reason why I don't like reproductive cloning. On the other hand, at some distant time in the future, if it was safe, I think you might produce a child by nuclear transfer as a way of preventing that child being born with an inherited genetic disease, like cystic fibrosis or Huntington's disease, or there are many other inherited diseases. I'm afraid I don't yet know very much about these, and this is something I need to learn more about.
And these would be what you call designer babies?
You could describe it like that. What can happen at the present time is that if a couple know that they are vulnerable to producing a child with an unpleasant disease, and if the genetic cause is known, then it's possible to have tests done on their embryos. And what happens now, which causes offence to some people, I understand, but is that the embryos which do not have the genetic error would be the only ones transferred into a woman's womb. Sadly, there isn't always going to be a normal embryo, because sometimes there aren't very many, and it's like throwing a dice. It won't always work, or perhaps tossing a coin is more accurate, because it's plus or minus, yes or no. So there would, in theory, be a possibility to take an embryo which has a genetic error, to grow out stem cells, to use molecular biology to correct the error, to use nuclear transfer to make a new embryo, which is a clone not of a person, but of the other embryo, and then to produce a child. And that would not be a twin of anybody else. And so to me, it would be an acceptable thing to think of doing. And if you say, you know, is it acceptable to think of using procedures to prevent children being born with an unpleasant inherited disease, I think most people would say that's a desirable thing to do.
But isn't there a slippery slope here? What would stop people from then going further and using that sort of technology to make smarter, more athletic, more attractive kids? And we're in Aldous Huxley land.
I think there are two reasons why that would be a mistake. One is that there's a big distinction between the thing I characterize as inherited disease, and I didn't say it, but it's inherited disease caused by an error in a single gene, and the characteristics that you listed, like intelligence, athleticism, any aspect of human personality, they're controlled by many genes. And each one of those genes is likely to influence many things. So what this means is that if you change one of those, it becomes an experiment. And what would happen sometimes is that somebody would have to sit and look at their children and say, well, you know, I'm sorry, son, we didn't mean this to turn out like this, but it did. So I just don't think that people would want to move into that sort of territory. And I don't think we can even begin to imagine yet when we would understand enough about these complex interactions to avoid that kind of experimentation.
Well, considering what we've been told about the future, maybe we can come up with a child who's immune to global warming. My guest is Ian Wilmut, W-I-L-M-U-T, the scientist who gave us Dolly. He has written a book with science writer Roger Highfield, After Dolly, The Uses and Misuses of Human Cloning. It is published by Norton. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, we're getting to the whole political issue here. I mean, there are political and religious issues for a lot of people. Many governments and non-governmental bodies have called for a ban on human cloning. Is it because they feel there is something to fear, or is it because of other issues?
I think there are many. But one of the reasons I was really pleased to work with Roger Highfield, who I should emphasize wrote this book, and it's his style, which is, I think, so easily readable and exciting, was to try to explain what's involved in cloning and to try to give people all of the information to make a decision. I, of course, understand that to some people, many of the things which we're suggesting are deeply offensive. But let me explain why I have a different view. And let me make a comparison with something which happened 40, 50 years ago. When people first transplanted organs from one person to another, Christian Barnard being the first in South Africa, there was great concern about this and an intense debate to decide when it was acceptable to turn off the life support machine for somebody and to use their organs. And most people came to the conclusion that if integrated brain function had ceased, it would be acceptable to do so. And that continues many countries, not everywhere, but many countries today. I think that there's an analogous stage at the beginning of life where you have a potential person, but it has not yet reached the stage in its development where, to me, it's acquired the most important human characteristic, which is to be aware, to be conscious, to have the ability to form sort of intellectual relationships with other people. Now, of course, that only develops to maturity many years, months, years later than the period we're talking about. But the embryo we're working with is so small, it's smaller than a grain of salt. It has maybe 200 cells. There is not even the merest beginning of the nervous system. It will be weeks before that begins to develop. So to me, this is analogous, if you like, slightly different, but analogous to this stage at the end of life, where there are some functions, but not all of them in people who are critically ill. And it's for that reason that it is acceptable to me, and I think a majority of people in my country, to take those cells and to use them in research and perhaps in therapy.
But by that standard, infants, toddlers, the socially inept aren't people either.
Yeah, this is a very difficult boundary to draw. You're quite right. I think that there is a difference in that there is absolutely no nervous system in the stage we're thinking of working with, whereas all of the others that you characterize, there is a nervous system. It may function differently from everybody else's, but it's there.
Now, there are other people who love this idea. There's a Canadian cult called the Raelians who are hoping to be able to clone humans. And aren't they putting a lot of money into their own research?
No, I think it might be fair. I'm not sure to say that they're putting other people's money into their own research. They say that they're intending to clone a child, but I don't think we have seen any serious evidence that they really are doing so.
Now, there's been a lot of cloning in science fiction over the years, from Faye Weldon to the classic science fiction writers. Do you have any favorite clones?
Actually not. It's not a subject that I've read much about, but Faye Weldon was one of the people who came to meet Dolly very early on in her life, and it was a great pleasure to meet her. She wrote a very nice piece about us.
When you're not in the lab, you are curling, aren't you?
That is an interest. Sadly, I've been so busy that I felt it's not been fair to stay as a member of the team because, you know, I can't play on all of the occasions, but it is a fun game and nearly impossible.
And for Americans, it's probably as difficult to explain as cloning.
Maybe, is that so? I would have thought that there is curling in North America because you would have had ice available in the winters. But the aim is to slide a stone which weighs about 45, 50 pounds, I'm not sure how many yards it is along the ground, to land in circles, as if much the same as a sort of a dartboard. And you achieve control over this by the amount of speed you give it and the way you spin it, because it, as it slows down, it will curl. And this can be modified by people sweeping on the ice. And so it's possible to get it wrong in an awful lot more ways than it is possible to get it right.
Well, that sounds like research as well. Back in the laboratories, if the research you're working on right now works out, what will you have achieved?
I think that we will enable people to study diseases and hopefully develop treatments for some of them. It's possible to carelessly give the impression that we'll develop treatments for all of them. And that in itself will be important. I think one of the main things, though, is we'll make people think differently. People are coming up with totally new strategies to think of ways of taking a cell from an adult and changing them into the type of cell that you want without making an embryo. And that may be the biggest inheritance of the Dolly experiment in the end.
Ian Wilmot has written with Roger Highfield, After Dolly, The Uses and Misuses of Human Cloning. It is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.